On February 13, 2016, Farm Radio International, alongside the Canadian Commission for UNESCO, in partnership with CHUO 89.1 FM in Ottawa and the NCRA, presented Boombox. Boombox was a panel discussion about change in the world of radio and how radio is adapting to new technology and how the new age of radio is changing the world. The discussion was hosted by Aaron Flynn, the station manager at CHUO 89.1 FM. You'll now be hearing the panel in its entirety, and you'll be hearing Aaron Flynn introducing the panelists.
We have three panelists here who have been making radio and audio, each with their own smarts and styles here in Canada. Nora Young, who's the host of Spark. It's a show about technology and trends on CBC Radio 1. Katie Jensen, who's the producer of Canada Land podcast and also hosts Indielicious. And right at the end is Doug Ward, who's worked for the CBC for over 30 years. He's the creator and founding producer of As It Happens, and is currently the board chair of Farm Radio International. So before we get into the conversation, I'd like to give a special thanks to Macmillan for sponsoring the venue, to community partners, CHUO 89.1 FM, who is broadcasting live, and the NCRA, which is the National Campus and Community Radio Association. And finally, to the title sponsor, the Canadian Commission for UNESCO, which connects Canadians with UNESCO, that's the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, through intercultural dialogue, knowledge sharing, and capacity building. The Commission connects and engages civil society and governments in the development of peace, peaceful, inclusive, and sustainable societies. Radio is an important means for the achievement of UNESCO's constitutional mandate. It contributes to UNESCO's commitment to develop and to increase the means of communication between peoples and to employ these means for the purpose of mutual understanding. There's more. UNESCO believes that radio greatly facilitates the free flow of ideas to the remotest areas, reaching out to most disadvantaged people and disseminating educational and cultural content. UNESCO strives for free, independent, and pluralistic media, as well as freedom of expression and freedom of the press. Okay, so let's get started. We're going to start with Nora. Can you tell us, what is your personal perspective on radio, how that's changed as the medium is changing in the last few decades?
Well, I guess for me, I came into radio right at the transition when we were both still cutting tape and doing digital editing at the same time. And so that's kind of the long lens through which I see this, is that long transition to digital. And I mean, one of the things that I really, when I was thinking about this, is that it's hard to remember back, but we didn't used to have a sense of what other people were doing. So craft meant really just what the people in the same building as you were doing. You had no idea, unless you actually physically traveled somewhere else, you had no idea what people were doing in Denmark or in, you know, Britain or whatever. So that's an amazing thing I think that's changed about radio. Obviously digital has made a huge difference in terms of making it not exclusively audio as well. I mean, what we're doing increasingly is becoming visual as well and textual as well as audio. The other thing I would say on the more negative side about how radio has changed is that I feel like, to me it feels in a way that we're in danger of becoming, I read about something on the internet and now we're having a commentary about it, as opposed to less kind of original journalism, and I think that's a little bit of a risk.
Katie or Doug, do you want to jump in, share your perspective?
Well, I think that one of the wonderful things in the electronic age and the digital age is that there's a free publisher out there called the internet, and so people who are very good amateur craftspeople who love audio, they can now have an audience without having a radio station to broadcast over. However, from a point of view of a registered, a licensed broadcaster, that is another source of competition. So that's a challenge, and it's one that we're going to have to face. But I think that there's so much to learn from all these amateurs and poorly paid people doing podcasts that the bigger public broadcasters can learn from them. And you, Nora, you raised that point. I think that we've got the public broadcasters have to listen. And then the public broadcasters also have to realize that a lot of their product will be listened to not over air, but by young adults who are washing the dishes or commuting to work on a subway.
I think it's interesting that podcasts have become part of the dialogue that we have with people at a party. Before, maybe 10 years ago, people would bring books, newspapers, magazines on the subway, pick them up from the newsstand, and now people download podcasts and slip their earbuds in. And they're really just proactively downloading stuff the next day to be a part of their normal commute. And I think the moment we'll know that radio is really changing is when, in a romantic comedy, one of the main leads works at like a podcast company like Gimlet, then we'll know that podcasts have really made the mainstream.
I think we're close.
Yeah.
We're really close. We'll be playing some video today throughout the webcast of people who do make radio and audio. So first up is Jesse Brown. He's the host and founder of the podcast called Canada Land that Katie produces. And it expanded to a full news site in 2014. Jesse would like to know about what podcasting and public radio can learn from one another.
So it looks to me like this generation of podcasters, a lot of them come out of public radio. And a lot of public radio sensibilities and values are coming into podcasting, and some of that is getting reflected back into public radio. So my question for the panel is, what should we keep of public radio as radio becomes podcasting, which it looks like it's gonna in one way or the other, and what should we lose?
Okay. Who wants to
should I
tackle
respond
that?
To my own boss?
I don't know if I say that.
Okay. Well, what I think that public radio can learn from podcasts is diversity, because podcasts are so low cost, so low risk. You can really take a gamble and get an unknown person as your host or your guest. You can really have as many guests as you want to kind of play with who sounds good. So you can really get a lot of people of color, women, alternative opinions on a podcast that you might not hear on public radio. I think that podcasts can learn how to do different things that are not currently explored in podcasts that are present in public radio. For example, there are not a lot of children's podcasts out there. So I think that podcasts can look to, you know, children's content on the CBC or TVO and see what's working, how to communicate to children and really translate that into podcasts. And I also think that podcasts can look at shows like Metro Morning and The Current and As It Happens to see how to turn around a daily news show that really reflects, you know, real-time news transactions that are happening. It's possible. I don't think anyone's doing it in Canada right now. I know that NPR has a daily show like that, but it's not being done in Canada. So I think that if a podcast company were to take that real-time news broadcast, I think that would be the next step.
Yeah. And then with the public radio perspective?
I think that, you know, first of all, right from when podcasting broke about 10 years ago or so, it was really like a tonic for, along with social media, really a tonic for public radio, and I think it shook up a lot of things in a really, really healthy way. And I think we still have a lot to learn from that environment in terms of the level of intimacy, the sort of peer-to-peer sensibility of it. On the other side, I think one thing I think about broadcast as opposed to podcast is that time is a great imposer of discipline on you. And I mean, I'm a huge listener to hobby podcasts or indie podcasts that relate to my own hobbies and interests. And I love the content, but sometimes I'm just like, get to the point. So I think there's some of that. And what I think is really interesting now, as Jesse sort of alluded to, is we're seeing this kind of rise of like sort of mini majors, as if to use the analogy from the music world, of things like Candleland or Gimlet in the US, that are really the sort of hybrid of the pure indie or hobbyist podcast and more of a sort of indie, but with a greater level of professionalism around it. That's a really interesting turn, I think.
Yeah.
I think that one thing that public broadcasting can help podcasting with is things like journalistic standards, because that's been argued out over 75 years in Canada, and I think we've got a pretty good set of them. And I think it's when you are broadcasting or narrowcasting, you have to have some sensibility about fairness and balance and accuracy. And I think these things can If you're mainly a craftsperson, those things aren't as important to you as sound and wonderful content. So I think that it's very important that those journalistic and programming standards be respected, perhaps not exactly as they are at the CBC. What the CBC and other public broadcasters can learn, I think, is because at this stage, podcasters are mainly broadcasting to intelligent young adults. CBC has got to find the way to bring those intelligent young adults into its radio audience every generation, and it's been a challenge since the beginning. And so I think that's, if you're in the CBC, you listen and you find out what's going on in podcasting and you steal.
I think that one show that's doing it really well on CBC that I love is Campus, hosted by Albert Lung. So I think that's a great example of something that the CBC is trying out and is working really, really well. And it's encapsulating all the things that I love about podcasts in America that are really storytelling-based podcasts. And it's also really appealing to me because it's targeting my demographic and it's telling stories that I care about. And although one of the guests was anonymous one day, I recognized that person from my undergrad, which was 6 years ago. So it was crazy. It was such a refreshing moment to actually hear a guest that was my age who was on the air and having their story told.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously there are like budgetary constraints as well as like time constraints with how much broadcast time is actually available, but I think it'll be really interesting to see as CBC starts experimenting presumably more with podcast only formats, mm-hmm. how like internally that can improve the culture of the organization and create more opportunities for experimentation.
I it's really interesting that Podcast Playlist was the first show in Canada to really have like a mélange of different podcasts that are happening, and now there are two more shows, one at Gimlet and one, I forget where the other one is located, that are exploring the same format. So it's really interesting that CBC pioneered that show style, which is cool.
It is. The broadcaster or podcaster, both are gatekeepers of information and conducting research, interviews, and they're telling or shaping a story that's broadcast to the listeners. So how does that responsibility affect your work? Do you think this responsibility changes at all based on broadcast versus podcast, what the implications or difference might be? Doug?
Well, I pretty well shocked my bolt on. I think it's really important that podcasters have a good sense of the ethics of any kind of publishing, that you're going out to a group of people at a particular time, you'd better be accurate, you'd better be fair. And balance is less important as long as you do balance over time. That is, you cover the most important things in an area over time. But those things are hard to do as you get to deadlines. So it's a pressure, and it's something that is at the heart of CBC broadcasting, and I think it's something that has to be taken up. But at the same time, you don't want to constrain podcasting too much because you want it to fly like a bird so you can see what the options and the opportunities are for this audio medium going forward.
Do you think the broadcasting has a larger responsibility than podcasting because of where the funding comes from, because of where the audience is, the expectations, do you see?
Well, it's certainly more policed, for one thing. And I think, you know, public media has a certain, I think, special responsibility in that regard. I think when it comes to being gatekeepers, a big part of the problem, and this speaks to your point about diversity, is just that it's not even necessarily deliberately exclusionary as much as it's like we all have blind spots. We all have blind spots based on our personal experience, based on, you know, our class and everything else. So that notion of diversity and getting a multiplicity of perspectives is, I think, really important in terms of addressing that notion of balance and fairness. I mean, from the more general perspective of being a gatekeeper, though, I think that, you know, who gets on Marc Maron's podcast, that's as much of a gatekeeper within the comedy world as, you know, who gets on Spark is within the technology world. So I think there's certainly like an ethical compulsion to be honest. At the same time, I think one thing that people really value about podcasts is that you can be, you know, hopefully fair, but certainly more perspectival, you know? Like, I have a hobby podcast that I do with my friend Kathy Bond, and it's really just the two of us spouting our opinions about what we think about technology and trends and media, right? And that's the gig, right? If you don't want to listen to that, then don't listen to the podcast, right? So, but within that, you still feel the responsibility to be fair, right? And to be accurate in as much as you can.
There are two points I want to make about this. The first is that as an investigative podcast, we bear a huge responsibility to protect sources. We bear a huge responsibility to get our facts right to the best of our ability as fast as possible. And we are also beholden to the fact that we are crowdfunded. We're also beholden to make sure that we are doing something that is worth funding. So every show has to be better than, you know, anything else we could make the day before. And the other point I want to make is because I think anytime someone is watching what you're doing, whether you're on the street and you're busking, or you're writing a column in the Toronto Sun, or you're making a podcast, or you're on the air, you have to be aware that the people you have on your show, the stories you choose to tell, those are all creating the standard bearer for the conversations that are happening in your country. So if the only voices that you're having on your show are cis white men, then you're basically setting the standard that those are the only voices that should be heard, and those are the only stories that are being told. So as a female, obviously white person, I'm always trying to really stretch the boundaries of who I know, who I can call upon in my network to bring on the podcast to make sure that I'm not just telling a story from my perspective, that we're hearing something outside of Toronto. That's a thing that I struggle with a lot because I am a little younger than some people. And it can be hard to find voices that are outside of Toronto for me personally. So in that way, I feel like a greater pressure and an urge to reach out to people in Vancouver and Halifax and Montreal and Saskatchewan, Regina, wherever.
Yeah, and deadline pressures always deadline come up pressure, against yeah. that, right? Because there's always the metaphorical Rolodex of the people that you can call on really easily, and stretching yourself to go beyond that is important, but it's a challenge.
Oh yeah, we turn around Shortcuts same day. So I just stopped producing Shortcuts, which is our weekly news roundup, and we would basically figure out the guest on the show the day before, get all the news clips, package them together, and then record at 3 p.m. and then have that up on the website, fully produced by 8 o'clock. So my first time I ever produced it, it took me 12 hours, and then by the last few episodes, it was taking me 3. So just the pressure of having to produce that and making sure that, you know, we had a steady list of people who sound good on the air but are also diverse is very important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's incredible. So we've all heard of Serial, I'm assuming. It's one of the most successful podcasts and definitely changed, I think, the playing field. It's in its second season now. I have not started listening, but I listened avidly to the first season. So I wanted to get your take on it. Did you listen to it? What is your perspective on it and how it plays into this conversation about radio as an agent for change and that, how that is changing overall? Start with Nora?
Sure. I did listen to the first season. I have not listened to the second season. I mean, my initial reaction, I think, like a lot of people in broadcasting or podcasting, was what a brave thing to do, to commit to that level of long-form storytelling is kind of incredible. And I remember when I first heard about it thinking, really? So that is incredible, how bold it was, and obviously it was really, really compelling storytelling. At the same time, though, I think as we've seen it in some ways set sort of a precedent. You know, we're starting to see Making of a Murderer and was it Jinx, that other one?
But yeah, Jinx.
The Jinx.
Yeah.
I have some level of discomfort around trial by media that I think is
absolutely
puts me a little bit on edge about it. But certainly, it I think like the notion of having that level of care and attention to telling a story. You know, certainly not the first time that journalists have gone back into cold cases or, you know, looked back on people who were convicted of a crime, but the potential there, I think, for careful journalism to be persuasive and to play a role in social justice is really interesting. But yeah, the trial by media thing makes me a little bit queasy, I have to say.
Yeah, they opened up the case, Adnan's case, again.
Yeah.
So it had some impact. Did you listen, Katie?
I listened to the first season. I kind of got into it late, which is great because I love binge listening to podcasts. I cannot stand just listening to one episode, a pilot episode, and then not knowing that there's more available to me if I love it. Some things I loved about Serial was the original composition done by Nick Thorburn of the Unicorns from Montreal. So that was really lovely to hear a Canadian composer featured on something that was so viral. I also loved that it was a really popular show. Like, the virality of that first season was insane. At the end of its run, it had over 120 million downloads, which is more than all of the people who listened to or watched Girls or Louie or Mad Men, which is crazy because those are such cultural institutions. So I love those two elements of it. I thought it was great that I don't have to say podcast and then tell everyone what I do. Oh, it's like radio, except you can listen whenever you want. So that was really convenient for me. And I have not listened to the next series, the next season, because although I really am fascinated by the work that Julie Snyder and Sarah Koenig did, I'm more of in a position right now where it's whet my appetite, but I really want to explore different true crime podcasts like Criminal and the fictitious podcast Limetown, which I highly recommend. And also even more sci-fi podcasts like Welcome to Night Vale are really interesting to me now. And I'm also really in the mood for female-fronted and story-told podcasts, not necessarily narrated, but podcasts like Another Round or Black Girls Talking, you know, those kind of podcasts. So I'm not really in the mood for true crime as told by Serial right now. But I'm sure it's great.
Oh, what about you, Doug? Did you listen to it?
I listened to about half of the first season's episodes. And by that point, I had had enough. I was less interested in the two protagonists. Why am I listening about these two people who I thought were quite good? I also had the concern about balance going forward. But what knocked me off my feet was what you're saying, the number of young adults who listened to long-form talk journalism. I think it was greatly helped by the music, the original music as a part of it. I mean, who in CBC gets to have the musical, original musical bridges in their programming? So some very important things were done right. And I think going forward, just the thought that you've got bright young people out there who really want long-form journalism in a serial format, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Although it's interesting that, I don't know if this is reflected in you guys here, but it's interesting that the four of us just said, yeah, we all listened to the first season and none of us listened to the second season. Who's listened to the first season of Serial here? Who's listened to a lot of people. Who's listened to the second season?
We got some fans.
More than us.
There's them.
I just wanted to add, and this may be a little bit of a sidebar, but it occurred to me when you were talking about how in the podcasting environment, how popular the personal storytelling mode is. I mean, it's long been, you can think of something like This American Life on radio. It's long had a place on radio, but it seems to have a particular strength in podcasting, and I wonder why that is. It's something to do with the intimacy of the headphones and the personality of it.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we have a question from the floor.
Yeah, we've got a couple online questions that I thought I'd ask you guys now. The first is, do you think podcasts offer a viable business model that can overcome sustainability issues that we've seen with commercial and public radios? So that question's from Mark LeClaire. Thank you for that question.
Thanks, Mark.
So Canada Land's obviously a good example, but is that just, you know, a one case of success? Is there a model for
future? We're just telling one kind of story. Our Canada Land is news and media criticism, Commons is a political podcast, and Shortcuts is our roundup. We're introducing an arts and culture show, but there are still so many different kinds of podcasts that you could do. Where's our sports podcast, right? There are so many different kinds of podcasts that we don't have the market cornered. Pacific Content just hired some big names. You know, maybe they're going to start churning out some branded content. There's still a lot of opportunity to fund your podcast. You just need to make a quality product, stick to the schedule. If you say this is a weekly podcast, you can't do two weeks in a row and then go off the map for 3 months because your listeners are going to say, well, this person's not taking this seriously. So, yeah, I think that it's a fundable model, and you just have to really commit to what you're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about what the business model is for this. I mean, you have your business model. Another model that people seem to be pursuing is branded content, whether that's to kind of, that's what Pacific Content is doing, whether you're in the business of producing something that's not, you know, insert positive message about Philip Morris cigarettes here, but it's just, it's, you know, it's branded content. Whether that's what you're producing on your own or whether that's something that you use on the commercial side to fund what you do as your passion project, that's something that we're seeing. My only note about this, because it's not my first time at this rodeo, like I was around for the first generation and wave of excitement of podcasting in 2005, 2006, where there were a lot of similar conversations about, you know, we're going to do branded content, or we're going to start these little networks that are going to draw more attention and bootstrap up the focus. And then after a few years, podcasts were not the sexy thing anymore, and it wasn't the sexy way to brand your company any longer. So I think that's a little bit of a cautionary tale in terms of some of the business model challenges out there. But on the other hand, a lot of things have changed now. I mean, people, you know, smartphones are pretty much the norm in Canada. People are used to consuming media on their mobile devices a lot more. That's the technology around it is a lot easier, both as a creator and as a consumer. So hopefully enough has changed that it'll be completely sustainable going forward.
And there's another question.
Yes, I have another question from the audience online. And it's about new media. It's from Christian Maduka. And he asks, is radio being challenged to the point of extinction by new media? We hear it a lot. Is radio dead?
No.
Well, let me go back a few generations. I mean, radio in North America was king until television came in. And then there was a huge transformational change. Television took all the kind of content that was could be visual, entertainment, sports, things like that, and of course it did news. And radio, there's a terrible shakeup. I mean, early radio programs, early radio stations were family stations. They did programs for adults and young people and the whole works. And when television came in, there was that chopping up. So you had rock stations and country stations and seven music of your life stations and up your yin-yang. And then and the CBC was left trying to do a broad spectrum. But, of course, it really went to certain kinds of cultural programming and certain kinds of information programming. So there's been huge changes to radio, and they will happen again. I don't think as much from digital production, but the listening habits of people. And your audience gets older, and what are their habits of using the media? So I think the important thing is that audio, that we have some well-funded public audio, and that's important, and CBC and others like that would be the ones to produce that or to buy that. And then I hope there will be a lot of digital podcasting from people who aren't in public broadcasting but are nipping at their heels all the time, holding their hand to the fire.
Absolutely. I think in some ways podcasting is really good for radio. It's putting it on the radar for people. So.
Yeah. I'm curious to know what you think as somebody who's involved in...
I'm really excited. I like this conversation. I think that I compare it often to like the Napster and the music industry, and not embracing the technology really caused some detrimental things to happen in the music industry. And I think that we have an opportunity right now in radio to embrace the new technology. And I see podcasting as a distribution platform for the content. And so that's the one that's popular now. Maybe it'll be something else. But I think the content, like Doug was just saying, it's still audio, it's still radio. It's just the way it's getting to people. So I think it's really exciting.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm asked this question, I always like to think, okay, what happens if you're in an environmental situation where, you know, there's a tornado in your town or there's a blackout? Are you going to listen to a podcast or are you going to turn on the radio?
Yeah.
Radio is not going to die until podcasts are real-time, like on the TuneIn app, and then they are radio. So I don't see a situation where podcasts replace radio ever. Netflix is never going to replace television. They can live side by side, compete healthfully.
I don't know about that.
Oh, I think there's always going to be a place for the 6 o'clock news on television forever.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm just going to take a quick minute to say that Pia has arrived. And is going to join us up here.
The first thing as a broadcaster or a podcaster is when your guest and your host arrive late. Yeah. I'm really sorry, it's Air Canada's fault.
It's winter in Canada.
Are you wired? Oh, you've got a...
I've got a hand. Yeah. Old school, Doug. Old school.
So, how do you want to...
You keep going.
Okay, we'll just jump in. So, we talked a little bit about Serial and that the first season of Serial illustrated the criminal justice system in America through one person's experience of it, and particularly towards the end of the podcast became a campaign for justice by the host Sarah Koenig. I guess the question is, do you want... what kind of impact do you want to have on your audience when you're broadcasting? So they clearly had a direction that they were going in. When you're doing your podcast or radio show, what is the impact that you're looking to have?
Well, I know the direct impact that we're looking to have is to give a voice to journalists and individuals who have been suppressed either institutionally or by a particular person. So for example, when we had Phil Demers on our show to tell the story about the systematic abuse of animals at Marineland, that was a story that wasn't getting told anywhere. It was certainly present online, but it was not given, I think, the due course that it should have. I mean, it was on Mark Maron in the US. He went on Mark Maron's show. But I think it was the kind of thing where we thought, this is a situation where, you know, St. Catharines and Niagara Falls are really close to home. Why don't we tell the story? Canada Land has really taken a stance on advocating for journalists such as Laura Robinson, Paul Watson, Bethany Horn. You know, this is one of the key things that we try to do, is to tell stories that are being suppressed by institutions, just because it's really important. We need to be that alternative voice.
Excellent. I think it's a different sort of, because of the scope of your show, the focus, I think the impact is maybe not in a political sense, but what is the relationship or impact that you're trying to build with your audience?
I guess for me, it's, I don't particularly have an idea of like, what do I want people to think about technology? For me, it's about the lens through which Spark looks at things is that technology has politics, and that's, you know, your assessment of what the political benefit, what the politics are, we're not trying to shut that down people's throats. But what I would like for people to have a sense of is that, you know, it's not a neutral instrument. It has ethics and politics and ideology and power baked into it. And that's sort of what we're about, right? And that's why we're not a show that does sort of, okay, this week a takeout on the CRTC or whatever. You know, it's like, why did I pick the CRTC? This week a takeout on X. It's really about, let's look at this new thing that probably has good aspects and negative aspects braided through with each other, and let's take apart what's implicit in that, right? So it's, I guess that's what frames it. And sometimes when I hear people complain about the show, they complain because they feel like it's too sunny. And I don't feel like it's sunny. I just feel like it's looking at things with an open mind, but with your critical thinking skills. So that's it for me, really.
Excellent. Do you want to...
If I can come in here from an African perspective, and although I'm not an African, that's our field of work at Farm Radio. Mm-hmm. For us, radio is simply a tool to transform rural Africa. I mean, it is not just about information. It's about helping small-scale farmers improve their productivity, improve rural society. And that means information, the best information at the right time for them in the cropping season, but it's also giving them a voice in development, because so much development planning is top down, but with what we encourage and train broadcasters to do is to get the farmers on air saying that seed that's available is crappy. We can't plant that stuff. It doesn't grow. There's too much, etc. And get people's voices who haven't been on air. Women, we have encouraged phone-in shows. You find that maybe 90% of the people who control the cell phones are men. So our radio station said, we've overcome that. We just have a second phone-in line, and we only allow women on that line. Wow. And then when we have a phone-in, we take a call from this line and then from that, so we have 50% women all the time.
That's
so there's a brilliant use of the technology, cheap, just a simple little solution. But the whole idea of what we're doing is giving a voice to farmers and then helping them to mobilize, because they're not just going to have a couple of individual people take up an improved practice. If there's a serious problem of degraded soil in your area, you need most of the people to improve, and so you've got to do things like interplant beans with corn so that the beans bring the nitrogen back in the soil. But people have got to sign on, and so you try to find out what are the major issues that farmers agree are important to them, but just they need that little nudge. And so we develop program series, the skeletons of them. All the work is done by the African radio station, but they get farmers talking about the issues and then rising up almost to a religious point where they say, now's the time to decide. Are you going to try this new practice now? Because we're going to have 2 months of programming about how you do it, and we're going to listen to you. And that's how that kind of time-bound series goes. And we've shown that you can have a huge effect. In 1 year, you can get 20% of all farmers in that area, 30% taking up the new practice. And if you do it a year later, you can get it up to 40 or 50%. So we aren't just information and society. We are trying to help rural Africans transform their societies and their lives.
It's very direct impact.
Very directly.
No. Yeah, do you want to?
I think your question, which was about cereal, I think we have to separate what cereal began as and what it maybe has morphed into other people sort of see it as. So it began as one story told over a number of weeks. So it was journalists doing journalism. I think the consequence of that has been a lot of activism built around that. And so to pick up on what Doug is saying, I think, you know, what's the engagement with our audience? What do we want that relationship to be? I think it depends where you work and who you're working for and all of those things and what your goals are. I think with Katie's using the example of Paul Watson, clearly Candleland, yes, are journalists, but they also do some advocacy within their journalism. And there is nothing wrong with that in this day and age, as long as you're absolutely transparent about it. What's my engagement with my audience when I work at various CBC shows? Broadcasting, to engage them, to make them think, to challenge their own narratives and what their beliefs are. That's my only engagement. There's no advocacy. There's no activism.
Okay. I think we're going to show some more video. This is Nick Vandercock, who hosts and creator of the award-winning and acclaimed podcast Radiotopia called Love and Radio. Nick is curious about the panelists' vision of podcasting in the developing world.
Well, I really cut my teeth on podcasting. I've been podcasting since 2005, so this feels like a very obvious question to me. But I'm curious... I'm curious what the future of podcasting is in developing regions around the world. I don't have a good knowledge of how popular it is or what kind of technology exists to allow people to podcast. So I'm curious if the panel sees a future of podcasting that's a bit more widespread than it is right now. And what does that look like?
So I'm going to throw this to you, Doug, because you have, I think, experience.
It's kind of speculative. There's not a lot out there yet. You have to have good connectivity, for starters, and that's a problem in a lot of the in developing countries. You have to have a smartphone or you have to have a tablet or something, a computer, and most poor people don't have those. So, however, if you're in an urban area in a developing country, I could see podcasts developing for sure, no question about it. The kind of adaptation you get in rural areas of Africa, I mean, you've got villages where there's no power, and yet everybody has a cell phone. Well, how does that work? Well, at night, some guy goes around, collects all the cell phones, bicycles to a town where there's power, and plugs them all in and brings them back. And you have young kids, entrepreneurial, they're taking people's cell phones and going to a place where there's the internet and loading them up with songs and bringing them back to that town. So all kinds of adaptability in Africa. And so I think it's just a matter of time. But I think podcasting is one of the things that's sort of in the future. But in South Africa, in big place like that, I'm sure there's podcasting, and I'm sure it'll spread a lot. But again, that'll be more a young urban elite experience.
Right.
I don't know Africa well, but in the slums of India, you know, just like you say, everyone's gathered, you know, in the slums around the one television or the one computer or whatever. Same in the Gaza Strip, and I would like to think of the future where people are still gathering around to listen to a podcast, but maybe in these areas it's about education. So maybe they're being learning how to read and write. If we think of many places in the world where people are being educated because they're poor, working, education is inaccessible to them, maybe podcasts can serve that that element first. I mean, I don't think people in the developing world are tuning in serial en masse yet, but I see a time where podcasts just replace people gathering around a television set or a phone, and everyone's listening to a podcast instead.
Yeah, it's, I mean, on the one hand, like when you look at the distribution of technology, I mean, people are talking about the next 2 billion, right? What happens when the next 2 billion people come online, mostly on mobile phones? And I think that's going to be a really interesting moment when, and most of those people will be in the developing world, is what happens when those people tell us how they want to use the medium, and what do they do with the medium of communication, whether that's podcasting or radio or whatever. I mean, it's but it just, so that was the one thing to say, like, let's see what they come up with. I would say on the more general thing, it seems to me that the great advantage that radio has is that it's great at local and it's great at live. Mm-hmm. And the great advantage that podcasting has is that it's great at connecting people who have a community of interest, whether that's a linguistic group or, you know, farmers or whatever. So I think it seems to me that it would depend on, like, what made sense for the particular developing area context, right? I just had a conversation with a colleague about people from the Somalian diaspora connecting. Okay. Over YouTube broadcasts. And that's an interesting, I mean, that might be an interesting case for podcasting, is the opportunity to connect diasporic communities with their communities of origin. Like, that would be a really interesting way to use all those kinds of asynchronous types of tools, not just podcasting. But
I also don't know, is podcasting mostly an English language thing right now?
There are lots of podcasts that are not in English, but the barrier is that I don't speak anything except English, so I can't speak to any other, but I do know some people who are like, oh yeah, there are tons. So I think just to chime in on the situation with the developing world, I think that a third of the world doesn't have access to 3G or 4G still. So we're talking like 10, 15, 20 years until everyone has access to internet. And then from there, the podcasts that I can see really taking foothold are, yes, educational podcasts specific to language acquisition. Yes, absolutely. Podcasts that are specific to farming, engineering, I think teaching people how to work with what they have, remnants of industrial processes. I think one of the, hands down, because the regions of the world that will be most affected by climate change within the next 50 years will be developing regions. I think that podcasts can act as an ability for people to become educated on how to remedy their immediate environment against the deleterious aspects of climate change. So whether that's drought or fire or increased epidemics of different diseases, I think podcasts can really serve as a tool to educate people on basic medical skills, basic survival skills, that sort of thing. So it'll kind of expand beyond what Farm Radio International is doing and really envelop things that are going to, we can only just dream about the crises that are going to happen in the next 50 years for these countries.
But until then, all they've got is radio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And radio is everywhere. 90% of the people in rural Africa have radio. And a huge number, in terms of the, that's great. That's got the penetration and And it's a relatively cheap production medium, but it's one way. But also in rural Africa, there are 100 million cell phones. 100 million.
Wow.
Now, they're not smartphones, but if you're doing a program about cassava plants, and some woman hears it and phones in and says, I've got white spots on the leaves of my plant, and then you find the ag expert and you say, what do you do about that? Well, it's just a simple solution like Ed Lawrence in Ontario. and that gets over the air and gets to the intended audience immediately. Well, think of the difference between the one-way radio and this new sexy new medium of radio plus the cell phone. So radio has been given a rebirth in Africa because of the cell phone.
Oh, interesting. There's a question from the audience.
All right. The question is, you've been talking a lot about the future of podcasting and education, having a really strong future there. What about a space for criticism? Katie, you might have a lot to say about this. So criticism in all kind of aspects, not just media criticism.
I think that there are a lot of people who have a lot of opinions, and podcasting is a great place to broadcast your opinion. So yeah, I think that criticism-based podcasts are a definite genre of podcasts that have a sustainable future.
Can I have an example in Africa? We walk a tightrope because we want to help rural communities improve the quality of their lives. Some of the countries are more democratic and some are less. I don't think anybody thinks of Ethiopia as a paragon of democracy. However, we're working there, and we're working there with the Gates Foundation because the government of Ethiopia spends more money on rural lives than per capita than any other country in Africa. So, but there are certain constraints about freedom of speech. We are told that the government has to approve who we interview, who the radio stations interview. Well, that's a pain in the butt for us. However, we've just taught the broadcasters to do phone-ins, and people phone in, and they haven't got any way to approve or disprove who phones in. So you're getting people saying, you know, we haven't seen the ag extension worker for 6 months. What's going on here? Or the seed that you're providing is not good enough for us, or whatever. And this is getting back, and so far we haven't been kicked out of Ethiopia. And in fact, I think it's forcing the government of Ethiopia to realize that in a way we're speaking truth to power in a way that they can accept. It's not that totally threatening to their democracy, and they're listening and they're making some changes.
That's exciting. Interesting. Do you want to add something?
I think, yes, of course, criticism will become part of the podcasting world. In fact, it already is. So, you know, the most successful podcasts, we all talk about probably the same 25 podcasts, and like blogs, they're the ones that rise to the top. There are hundreds and hundreds of podcasts. Most of them that are full of criticism are sports podcasts. And they're full of criticism, depending on who's telling, you know, if it's the Leafs podcast, they're critical of the Senators, right?
They're critical of the Leafs.
No, that's true. That's true. Good point, Doug. I think there's lots of, I'm sure you've established this, and, we're at the beginning of where podcasts are going to go, and I think people are going to start twisting and turning them into, and morphing them into other things other than just kind of straight ahead storytelling and interviewing.
Sort of cautionary note about criticism in podcasting is I think that it does have the potential to produce that kind of echo chamber kind of effect. You know, that if you're, I'm quite unlikely to sign up to listen to a podcast with somebody who has a point of view that I radically disagree with, unless I am an extremely open-minded, person who's willing to challenge myself. Most of us are not like that. So to me, that there's a little bit of an echo chamber issue there, unless you're using it. I mean, what I really like is the idea of it as a forum. Like, you've done some great things like this on Canada Land, like where it's a forum for like lively debate and discussion, right? And it's got perspective and it's got teeth, but it's not necessarily just a, you know, straight up rant about or critique in that sense, right?
Because it becomes hard to listen to, just ranting. Radio, it does. Radio, we know. Yeah, exactly. We know flourishes around the world. We want to play another video. This is from David Okidi, who is the host of public radio Mega FM in Uganda. His show sent messages to young rebels in the Lord's Resistance Army to come back home and call for peace. It paved the way for peace talks between the rebel group and the government. So we'll take a look at his video.
I would like to take this opportunity to greet all broadcasters as we celebrate this year's World Radio Day. I would like to talk a little bit about the role of radio in peace building in northern Uganda, a case of Mega FM where I was its station manager from 2001 to 2011. Mega FM is a government-owned radio station that was set up with financial support from DFID to target LRA combatants to heed to the call for peaceful settlement of this conflict, return back home, and benefit from the amnesty law that came into force in 2000. The radio station, therefore, developed a weekly radio program called Come Back Home, or in the local language, Glukpacho, that was being aired every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday from 10 to 11 p.m., appropriate time that the LRAs were able to listen to the program. The phone-in radio program featured on reaching the rebels with amnesty messages by giving them opportunity to return back home and narrate their stories so that they're able to convince their fellow combatants, stroke abductees, to actually abandon rebellion and come back home. The program featured former LRA combatants who assured those still fighting and in captivity that they will not be killed if they surrender to the government, and that the community would also forgive them. The radio program really created a lot of impact between the year 2000 and 2006 by convincing a big number of rebels to come back home. On average, about 10 to 20 of the rebels were returning back home every week, paving way for peace talks to commence between the rebels and the government of Uganda in the year 2006. Through this program, Mega FM actually acted as a confidence building tool for both the rebels and the people in the community that this program was about peace building and making sure that the conflict in the region came to an end.
Yeah, so radio in the developing world has played an integral role in many conflicts and emergencies and natural disasters. The intimacy and emotion radio can draw from someone's voice through the airwaves has been a key to approaching sensitive issues. And while David's story is an example very much from a particular time and place, I'm going to throw it to you, Doug. Can you tell us about your experience in handling sensitive topics with your audience? And then maybe.
Well, radio in Africa has quite an interesting background. It was started during the colonial period and was mainly in English or French or German or Portuguese, the language of the colonial masters. And then after the independence movements in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it became, unfortunately, not the voice of the people, but the voices of the new elites and the new big men, as they were called, the big man governments of Africa. And so they were propaganda tools for the state and for the government in power, and keeping that person in power on and on and on. The other kinds of broadcasting, a lot of religious broadcasting, a lot of North American money going in there to convert people. And then, of course, you see the power of radio in places like Rwanda and Kenya, where they didn't start genocide, but boy, were they useful tools for the people who were who were convicting the genocide. So it can be a very powerful tool, and too often it hasn't been very good. And if that wasn't enough, so much of African radio was boring, just boring, because they had as models BBC French radio, and the content would be delicious, but they couldn't afford the content, but they had all the pretentiousness of BBC presenters, for example. And so we come into that environment, and we hire young people from private radio in Africa to run a show on health on rural teenage depression, and they don't know what hit them. They just can't believe it. All they hear are teenage voices and the best music around and talking about depression and mental health as if it's normative for teenage Africans to do that, and it never has been. So there are wonderful things. It's a great tool. One thing I'll say about the sensibilities of the audience, we found out in one area that the land was so bad that they had to work on the soil more than anything else, the land. And so, but they won't give up on planting corn. They have to have their maize, as they call it. That's what they eat. So you mix maize and a legume. So you encourage that. Well, then we were told by a Muslim farmer that we couldn't do that because maize is a sacred crop to Muslims, and you can't mess around with the way you plant it. Well, of course, as Canadians, we all backed off immediately. You know, sorry. And then we thought, wait a minute. So we said, let's talk to some imams. Let's talk to some theologians about this. How did this become a sacred crop? Well, you talk to theologians, they said, there's nothing sacred about corn. It's a Mesoamerican crop that was brought over as part of the colonial, you know, nothing sacred about that. But what is sacred to us is the land. We said, yes. And so you've got to be careful that you don't just back off on critical programming. There's just one example, and there'd be many. And one thing that I have found, though, is that as Canadians, we've got this rich experience of farm broadcasting going back to the 30s on the CBC. And it's known all over the world. UNESCO put out a book on it in the 50s. It's copied all over the world. But today, we tend to say, I hope you don't mind if I've got some ideas to help you, because people are just want to engage with you. And you say, what we say is, try this out as a model. Tear it to shreds if it doesn't work in your culture. Fix it, adapt it, do what you want. But at least react to this. Make something better if you want. And that's a great way to engage young Africans. They're delighted. They're delighted to work with us. We have mentors. A lot of them are CBC producers who we send programs to, and they, in their spare time, do critiques of programs that African broadcasters are making. And they kill for that. They've never had training like that in Africa, and they never could get it. So we have to be careful that we're not too shy about, you know, take our light out from under the bushel, but be culturally sensitive too, and understand that some things are going to be very different for them. I mean, we called it survival programming, which was, you know, what's the weather like, and what's your commute going to be like? And every morning show has to have that survival information. So we used that we said, okay, you've got to have survival information in your farmer program. Well, of course, for them, survival program was surviving. And we just used the wrong word. So we had to back way off on that. And that kind of thing happens all the time. But that's the exciting exchange for us.
Does anyone else want to comment quickly on... I think we're getting close. We've got some time. Trying to read your sign language. About their experience handling, you've probably had to deal with some sensitive topics.
Absolutely.
On Canada Land.
I think it's really important that we're conscious of confidentiality, anonymous sources. We have a public key. We keep information. I mean, trust is so easily broken. It can be broken in a second for anyone, whether they're a broadcaster or a podcaster. So we absolutely take it seriously, and we also have audience listeners who are really, really great at telling us when we've gotten something wrong, because we are based out of Toronto. It's incredible when someone says, hey, you know that story you reported on in Yellowknife? That's actually not what's going on. I'll actually write a piece for you so you can get your story straight. So when we do get it wrong, it's great that our audience is able to immediately tell us. And at the end of every show, we always give our Twitter handle and our email address. So we think it's really important to be very aware of what we're putting out there into the public domain.
And being open to the feedback.
And being open to feedback. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, Honora, do you have...
Well, I think, I don't know, I reported from the Middle East for 3 years and everything was a sensitive issue there. So I think for me, if you go back to your fundamentals of journalism, really, and then add to that some compassion about the people you're talking with and interviewing, I'm just trying to think what is a sensitive issue that we would talk about in Canada. I can think of someone who's a victim of sexual assault or mental health issues, which are sensitive in that you need to be compassionate for people, as you should be always. But we don't have taboo issues here. And I think it's different when you're talking about in Africa, where if sensitive issues could land you in jail or worse, or in other parts of the world. So I'm not sure really how to answer that question. I think just, be human, use your journalistic rigor, have some compassion in life, and that should guide you, I think, pretty good.
Okay. I think there's a question from the audience.
We're going to throw it to Barry Rook and then this gentleman right here, right after.
Hi, Barry from the NCRA. I had a question specifically. There is a challenge in campus radio across the world, happens here in Canada quite often, around defunding. What would you say specifically to those groups that don't value or view the work of campus or community radio stations as worth putting in $7 or so a semester?
I guess this is going to me because I still have a campus and community radio station. So I guess I would ask, defunding by the students, like the student unions taking out the funding, or defunding by the community members. I mean, those are two separate issues. I think if the students aren't listening to the community station on their campus, then perhaps something needs to be done to reinvigorate. The first thing that you came to mind when you said that was when Ryerson's station got their funding pulled, I think, and the whole station was axed because of the way that it was managed. And I think that's, something that was very case specific. But I think any time that someone says, you don't deserve to be doing what you're doing anymore, and we're going to take away your funding, it's a situation where you have to reflect at what you have been doing, why someone's reacting that way, and, really putting a lot of energy into showing and illustrating the value of what you're doing.
Okay.
One, very briefly, because I had some experience with the Carleton station when it was going through a terrible time. A community or a university station has to have at least one program that is a must listen for every student. It has to be so energizing, it has to be so edgy that you just have to listen, or because it's going to be talked about in the pub that night. If you don't have that show, you're going to get defunded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
It's content. If you have good content, people will want to support it.
I mean, they'll let you do what you want from 6 in the morning till 11 in the morning because they're never going to hear it. So that's where you can put all the elite kind of schmaltzy kind of stuff, even jazz, I guess. But you've got to have a show at a time. You see, most university people don't listen to a lot of radio because they're getting information in other ways. But there has to be a compelling show. I don't know what it is, but hell, you're all in university. You must know how to do it.
Okay, well, we have 1 minute left. We will get to your question after the webcast. But first, I guess if can we quickly do 10 seconds what people want to leave as a word about radio in the future, where we're going? Literally 10 seconds. Do you have anything?
I think I'm really excited to be in audio right now. I think it's an amazing, it's a fantastic time.
I agree.
My job is very fun. That's all I have to say.
We work with young broadcasters in Africa. We want to get young Canadians helping to support that. So get into farm radio, find out what we're doing, hook up with us. I don't know what the verbs are anymore, but find out more about us and help us.
I don't think hookup is the right word. Do I really have 10 seconds? I've got 1 second.
You have a minute.
I always say we have been using our ears to hear stories since the beginning of time. That is not going to change. I find the debate between podcasting and broadcasting a little bit rich because all we are doing is telling good stories and listening to them. So long live audio, radio, podcasting, whatever you want to call it.
Thanks to Macmillan, thanks to Farm Radio, and thanks to everyone here who came out and everyone who watched online.
Thank you.
Yes, here. Thank you.